Courage is the most important of all the virtues, because without courage, you cannot practice any other virtue consistently. Maya Angelou. Welcome to This Fruitful Mind. My name is Kevin McCormack and I've got a fruitful mind. I'm a writer, actor, mindfulness teacher, mediocre musician and all-round creative type. My aim in life is to impact as positively as I can on as many people as possible and have a laugh along the way. This is my podcast about everything and anything, but mostly anything. All opinions expressed are my own, except the ones that belong to the voices in my head. And be advised, this podcast occasionally contains what some might consider explicit language. I did promise at the outset that on the occasions upon which I would be lucky enough to get to interview someone for this podcast, that I would strive to interview as diverse a mix of people as I could. My guest on this episode of This Fruitful Mind is June Murphy, a former politician who now works as a domestic violence support worker with the YANA North Cork Domestic Violence Project, the YANA standing for You Are Not Alone. June and I have been acquainted for a few years now, and outside of what I have learned of her through following her work as a county councillor and community activist, I don't really know a whole lot about her. So I reached out to June a short while back to see if she'd be up for doing an interview for the podcast, and I was delighted when she said yes. So we took to Zoom to have our chat, so you'll excuse the occasional wobble and dropout in the audio, but you'll quickly discover for yourself that the few minor technical issues don't take anything away from this remarkable lady's tale of courage and hope. I hope you enjoy June's company as much as I did. June.
Yes.
You're very welcome to This Fruitful Mind.
Thank you, Kevin. I'm looking forward to it.
I've been really looking forward to you and I having this chat, really, since I contacted you and you agreed to do it. I have a lot of questions for you. Just in terms of your experience in politics, and you know, I'd like to chat with you as well about the role that you're in now, that I mentioned in the introduction there as well. So I suppose let's start at the start. A little bit about family life, June. I know that you live in Mitchelstown. Are you Mitchelstown born and bred?
I'm Mitchelstown born and bred, but I did leave for a number of years, Kevin, where we lived in Ennis for about 7 or 8 years. And then we actually, before Derry, my son, started secondary school, we decided if we were going to move, we needed to do it then. And Derry was actually the one to really push that forward. He wanted to come home, you know, because before that, we'd started to come down for a lot of weekends and he started bonding with his cousins and his grandparents. Yeah. So I just wanted to be sure that that's what he wanted. So I was kind of planning it for about a year before we made the move. But it is, it's lovely to have come back and re-establish old links and, you know, for Derry to have an opportunity to know his family.
You're one of a family of six, June, are you?
I have 3 brothers, 2 sisters. My mother has passed. Dad is still around, still tinkering around and fixing things and all that kind of jazz. It keeps him young.
And I suppose Mitchelstown is a very different place to what it was when you were a child as well, is it?
Yeah, like it was very bizarre. I got lost on the way back in because, you know, all the bypass was there. None of that was there when I left. I was like, my God, where am I going? I can't even find my parents' house. But there was a dramatic change. But at the same time, nothing changed. You know, Galty closed down. I was expecting kind of new industry to be in the town. There was nothing. There seemed to be a lot more unemployment and poverty around, which I didn't expect. People got older, they got heavier, they got slimmer, you know, so.
Yeah.
And of course, when I left so quickly. I left my home, clothes, furniture. We left everything behind us and we just disappeared one day. So when I came back into town, everyone knew me as the person I had left, you know.
Right.
So their image of me or their knowing of me would have been with my partner at the time, our child, and so on. Whereas I had moved on 8 years, do you know what I mean?
Yes.
So a lot of the old conversations and names would have been brought back up to me that right. I hadn't spoken about in years, and I hadn't, you know, or people just trying to find out what you'd been up to, curiosity. Yeah. And that was kind of hard to deal with at the start. It was like in my own brain, I was thinking, Jesus, I feel like I've stepped back in time. But
yeah.
No, we settled down pretty quick, found a place to rent and put some roots down. And, you know, it was just nice to be near my sisters, just around the corner from mum and dad. And again, you know, Derry never had the opportunity to grow up with family around him because it was always just the two of us.
Right.
So for him to go from just the two of us to this big, massive family was a challenge as well.
And you mentioned as well that you left everything behind you. We'll get to that a little later on because it's a big part of your story and it's a big part of what has brought you to where you are now and the work that you're doing today. You know, just listening to you there, even, you know, when you mentioned the expectations maybe that you had of Mitchestown. Well, a couple of things are clear to me anyway, right? One, your home, and Mitchestown is home. You also mentioned, you know, that you maybe had a little bit of an expectation in coming home, and you kind of alluded there to it a while ago that so much has changed, but everything is the same, right?
Yes.
When you first got involved in politics, I mean, what motivated you at the time?
I suppose even in school, I loved history. And I remember, God, this is going, I was very young, but I remember seeing an interview with Margaret Thatcher on TV.
Right.
And she referred to us as the Irish, but the way she said it sounded like she was almost spitting the word out. Now, I was only a child, and I remember thinking, why does she say it like that, you know?
Yeah.
The Irish, like as if it was an insult or something. I picked up these tones. I didn't really understand it. I was so young.
Would you have been maybe a teenager at this stage, or?
I wouldn't be far off it now, Kevin.
Yeah.
I'd say. And it just made me curious to find out a little bit more about who she was, the whole Irish thing. And of course, obviously, I did find out why she had the attitude she had when she said our names. And it just made me a bit more curious to do a bit more digging and searching. But yeah, it kind of moved on. And then I kind of wanted to become more active locally. And of course, you had the usual brigade, the O'Keefes and the Sherlocks and all that. And every...
Which would have been Fianna Fáil and the Labour Party. And yeah, and there would have been the obligatory Fine Gael offering as well. Yeah.
Yeah. And it never seemed to change. But I wanted to get active in local kind of politics, but I never felt that that door was open to me. Probably one, because we weren't made of money. And that was the feeling I got. And two, I was a woman. So there never seemed to be a kind of a future in that for someone like myself. But all I wanted to do was to try and help my town. Because even though we had all these politicians, we didn't seem to have much happening in terms of young people and services there for young people, the prospect of jobs and college and all this kind of stuff.
Any kind of a future.
Yeah, it didn't seem to be, to me anyway. So I remember then the ceasefire in the north happened. And at this stage, I was buying on Poblacht from a guy that used to sell it around town. I used to grab one off him and I'd read it and I'd be fascinated yeah. by the stuff in it. And they always seemed to honor and push the women forward in their party, which was something I never saw with the other parties.
They being so, Sinn Féin.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, yeah. Which kind of brings me to a question that I did want to ask you. Did you find Sinn Féin, June, or did Sinn Féin find you?
I suppose my partner at the time were interested in them as well. And they wanted to go to functions in Cork, these fundraising functions, like they'd have bands play like the Spirit of Freedom and, you know, the Wolf Tones and all that kind of stuff. So we started going to them, and then we started going into the Sinn Féin shop, buying memorabilia and all that kind of stuff. So they got to know our faces from being in around it. Mm. And we were invited to some talk about drugs, and they had some speakers down from Dublin, and the press was going to be there and radio was going to be there. Wasn't really sure what the whole thing was about, to be honest. Mm. They just wanted bodies on seats. So we went up anyway, because my partner was really, he really wanted to please them. He just thought they were gods. Like, he just really wanted to please them. And we went up, and it turned out that somebody who was supposed to be on stage didn't turn up. So they came to me and they said, "Will you sit up there?" And I said, "No."
Right.
And I said, "Not a hope." And they said, "Look, you don't have to say anything. You just need to sit there." And I said, "Are you sure?" And they said, "Yeah." So I said, "Okay." So I went up, and it started and it continued and people were talking. And the next thing, they turned around, they gave the mic to me. And we were talking about suicide and stuff. So I remember my legs were like jelly. I was having a panic attack on stage. So I just started talking. And I talked about a story that I knew of. And that was it. And from that moment on, apparently they kept playing that clip on the radio and it picked up a lot of press. From that moment on, eyes were on me. And then about 2 months later, there was a meeting and we were in somebody's kitchen and they wanted to know would I run the general election.
And what year was this, June?
That was, oh God, I think it was 2002. It was okay, the days yeah. where we were being run out of houses, not welcomed.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
It was in the real old days, you know?
Yeah.
So my partner had told them I would, and I was saying I wouldn't. And I was afraid, you know, I wasn't prepared for something so huge. But anyway, I did. I ended up doing it. And it was an incredible experience. It really, really was. Just meeting so many different people. Martin McGuinness came down. Pat Doherty was down. Barbara de Bruyn was down. They all came down to help out. I just couldn't believe it. Like, it was amazing. And of course, we were invited up to Dublin and stuff as well. And I always seemed to be placed next to Jerry. So he always had women around him. And I remember sitting in a meeting in the Mansion House, and Jerry was kind of given his 15-year plan. And back then, he even said that come local elections in years to come, that he would be running female candidates in every electoral area. And this was like 15 years before or something. Like, it was, I thought, this man is, wow, like...
You thought that this guy is really sort of bucking the trend. So would you say that as a party that Sinn Féin were maybe that bit ahead of the curve in terms of identifying that maybe having more female candidates in local and general elections, that was it to maybe sort to soften the kind image. Of the public perception and the image of the party that was out there?
Very much so, you know, yeah.
Was it a tactical thing, or do they genuinely care about having women in public life?
I think it's a combination of all, really, Kevin. Because, you know, they had so much experience from the elections above in the north that they implemented down here. I remember we did canvas training with them. And it was only in the election in 2016 that I saw other parties beginning to use the same canvassing technique.
Okay.
Whereas Sinn Féin were doing that years before.
And what is that technique? I mean, what is there about the approach that's different?
They just had a different approach about when you're coming to somebody's house, the respect that you show, not jumping houses, closing gates. When you get to the door, don't ask for daddy, ask for mammy. Mammy is the centre of the family unit. She carries the vote. They talk about this kind of stuff over the dinner table. There was a lot more strategic kind of elements in it. But I remember just, you know, thinking, this is mind-blowing stuff. Like, you know, they really looked at every angle. And of course, that had been perfected due to the elections in the north. So they brought their knowledge down. And they're very good at it. And of course, because they're so good then at the grassroots politics, they have the feet on the ground. They have the membership on the ground that get involved voluntary and otherwise. That's all being fed back into the bigger machine. So they're constantly in touch with what's happening on the ground, what affects people, what they're happy about, what they're unhappy about, that kind of stuff. So it's grassroots links, really, that's your bread and butter, you know? And they're very good at it and very strong at it. So, you know, I did like that side of them as well, I must admit. And there are some really, really lovely, good people in the party, you know. They weren't all horrible or bad. There's some very genuine people who want to do goodness. When you meet them in their bed, they're very bad. And I think the party has expanded so much that maybe the finger isn't on the pulse as it should be to manage that.
So you came on, and let's use the analogy, we'll say, of almost of a love story, right? Was that you appeared on the radar, right? They begin to notice you, you know, you're turning up at a few events, and then they spot you in and out of the shop buying a few bits and pieces, and you know, then you become a regular face. The opportunity came then, you know, where they, you know, and I mean, you weren't prepared for it, where you ended up speaking at a public event. So there was almost a kind of a courtship started. And then by the time the 2002 general election came, they decided that they were in love with you and they proposed, right? And they said, June, you know, will you marry us? And, you know, and run in the general election. So, and I find it fascinating that there was actual training in how to canvass, like, because genuinely, as somebody who has opened my front door several times over many years to gobshites of all different shades and tendencies and leanings, you'd honest to God, you think like that somebody dropped them in a car at the front of the estate and said, off you go now, knock on the doors. And they, you know, and you get people then who have been in public life forever, who hand you a flyer and say, you might think of me on the day. And I'm kind of there left at that. And I'm there thinking, this now is all you've got to say for yourself. You might think of me on the day. I went off on a bit of a tangent there. I wasn't aware that people were trained in how to canvass with an election candidate. That you're after blowing my mind there now. Like, I just thought that they land on the door and make it up as they go along, you know?
No, and they also do media training as well.
Well, you know? I'd expect the media training, you know. I mean, I can totally get that because, to be fair, there are people who, and I would venture to say, you know, that there are people there that even with all the media training in the world, they can't put a sentence together, like, you know what I mean? They're just, you know, there's no cohesion when they speak. There's nothing. And it, like, no matter how well-intentioned you are, you know, unless you can communicate clearly in that, you know, you're on a hiding to nothing. So I would totally get that. But going back to the courtship, we'll say, right? So they run you in a general election and you get to meet Martin McGuinness and other such great figure. And you get to sit at the top table with Gerry Adams and all of this goes on. But there came a time for you, June, when the honeymoon ended. You left Sinn Féin in, was it 2015 you left?
No, I actually left after the general election in 2002 due to personal issues. I didn't want the two to become embroiled, so I couldn't cope with being in the party and doing the work that's expected of you in the party, because it's a lot, and then try to manage home life as well. So I actually just said, look, I have a few personal things I have to sort out. I need to step away.
And but did you return to the fold again after that?
Yeah.
Like when in your time as a county councillor, you were a Sinn Féin candidate. And that was later on though, wasn't it? Was that?
Yeah, so that was for the 2014 elections.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so I'd say I had returned to Mitchelstown in 2012, and somebody saw me, fed that back into the party that I was back. And what I found out later was the same individuals were told to stay away from me, and that somebody in a higher position than them would make contact with me. But they went ahead and made contact with me anyway.
They jumped the gun.
So they wanted to talk to me. So I met them and I talked to them, and I walked away thinking I wouldn't touch them with a 10-foot pole, right?
Right, yeah.
And I left. And so somebody gave me a phone call and they wanted to meet. I said, sure, I've already met you. And they went mad because...
Because you weren't supposed to have...
Yeah, it wasn't supposed to have met. And they asked, did I think about it? And I said, look, there's nothing to think about. I said, it's a no from me. So then they were saying that, you know, it's a lot different now. It's more professional. It's changed a lot, to give them a chance and to meet with them. So I would have known this person back 20 years ago. So I met them. The meeting was a lot more professional. And they asked me to think about it. So I said, look, if I'm doing this, I need to talk to my family about it. So I talked to the family. They were all for it, which I didn't expect, actually. I thought they'd say no. They just said, no, go for it. We need a change. You'd be a sitting TD now if your life hadn't gone the way it went, kind of thing. So I felt a lot better about, I said, look, if I do go for it, I'm going to really need your support. Because like, I'm only back in town. And, you know, a lot
back
of my
in
friends...
Back in town and with a teenage child.
Yeah. And, you know, no friends because they were in Clare. And, you know, anyone I did know beforehand had moved on to different countries or were living in Cork. So I really needed the support. And they said, no bothers, we got you. So I went back anyway and I agreed to do it because I had been here for nearly 2 years. I couldn't get a job. I was like, this is ridiculous. I'm applying, like I applied to Jesus hundreds and couldn't get anything. So I said, why not give it a lash, you know?
Mm.
And I did. And from the minute I said yes, the whirlwind began.
And what was the whirlwind? What was that like? What was the experience?
I unknowingly stepped into a civil war that was going on between a number of commons in the East Cork electoral area.
Okay.
Yeah, it was very difficult. So there were several commons who wanted the sitting TD out and had asked that there were two individuals who'd aspirations of winning two seats. One down by Cove and the other one back by Mallow. And the other common members were doing things. There was just so much going on. Like, and I have to be careful because I was only hearing one side of the story.
Mm.
And then they were pressurizing me to pick a side. And I was like, there is no side. We're all in the same party. There should be no sides. And the more I held out not picking a side, they picked a side for me. So I was with the sitting TD in their eyes because I wouldn't join their campaign of bullying and all that kind of stuff. And then they started doing it to me. And it was horrific. Like it started from canvassing, like I would get a call from the person who was over my kind of campaign, and he would give me a time and a date to be wherever to go canvassing. But the others would have gotten a different day and different time. So they'd turn up, I wouldn't be there, and it made me look unprofessional because he was messing around with the dates and the times. I remember they invited me to a meeting. They pulled out this long list of things that I was doing badly. They read it out. I walked out of the meeting. I was like, what is going on here? Just getting phone calls from them and the other person that wanted to be a sitting TD, telling me how badly I was doing things, nitpicking at me all the time, trying to find out how many members I had down here, because they wanted to know if they were up against me or Sandra, how many numbers they needed to beat in a contest if it arose. There were just
Sandra being Sandra McLellan, who was she was the sitting TD, was she?
She was, yeah.
Right, yeah. Okay. And Sandra's down around, is she down around the All Side or somewhere, is it?
Is, yeah.
Right, yeah. Okay, yeah, yeah.
No, okay. I didn't know Sandra at all before I came into this. And I have to say, she was lovely to me when I came in. Such a difference from the way they treated me to the way she treated me. And this just went on. All these kind of mad head games went on. And it was like a slow dripping tap, constantly eroding your confidence. And of course, then some political analysis predicted two seats and then named two candidates to win those seats, which was Sandra and myself. And when that was released, the campaign was upped.
Right.
So you'd, you know, people coming in, taking issues from my area, working on them, just anything that they could disrupt, they disrupted. And then they got family members to writing complaints about me, you know, making out that I wasn't doing my job as a councillor. This continued even after I got elected. Actually, the day that I got elected, I didn't find out I was elected till about 5 a.m. And then at 7 o'clock that night, I got a phone call from my common member, inviting me to my election party that I knew nothing about. And I was like, I was exhausted because I hadn't slept. And come on over. It was like, and I was like, but I know nothing about this. Why am I only hearing about this now? You should be here. You're our candidate. We helped get you elected, which they didn't, because I hadn't gone canvassing with them in, I'd say, 2 months.
Right.
I was out canvassing with my family. And I was like, but sure, I have Derry. I've no one to look after Derry. I said, I've been gone since the day before. I need, like, can we not do this tomorrow night? No, wasn't good enough. And then they went and they told everyone that I didn't even bother showing up to it, even though I knew nothing about it. You know, it was all that kind of nonsense.
It's insane, you know, that, and I know now that it's a term that's kind of being bandied about an awful lot recently. And I think really, you know, maybe because I think there was a storyline in one of the soap operas, but it sounds like, it sounds to me like you were gaslighted, as they say. Do you know what I mean? You know, and I know that you told me previously that you were just burned out anyway. When the 2018 general election then came around, you ran for the Social Democrats.
Yeah.
How did that come about? If you don't mind telling me that, like, I mean, you know, keep it brief, like, but I'm curious as to how
one of their people made contact with me. Actually, I went with a friend who were in talks with them to be a candidate for them. And he taught me to come along, and I went along and we started talking. And by the end of it, my friend had stopped talking and I was still talking with your man. We were more or less on the same wavelength about a lot of issues. So anyway, I met them a few times, and then I was invited to meet Catherine and Roisin in Dublin, and we went up and we met them, and I agreed to run for them. I was a bit unsure because I was really burnt out, and I was thinking to myself, do I really have it in me to do this again? You know, and they were saying like they could support me and stuff like that. But to be honest, the support wasn't great because it's a very Dublin-based party. And then I didn't have the same support as I had when I ran for Sinn Féin from my family, because they were all off doing their stuff. They just hadn't the time to commit. So I was on a backpedaler from that. And then I didn't really have the money to run a campaign either. So what could go against me was against me. And they had a very different way of doing things, which I found difficult. There would have been a lot of debating and stuff like that, whereas I would have been used to getting out on the ground and getting stuck in. But there seemed to be too much debating and no grassroots action, if you know.
So, I do. I totally get you.
It wasn't their fault. They weren't doing anything wrong. It was just, you know, there was a lot of very young college people in it. They had a different way of doing stuff. And I learned a lot from them in that way. But I was an old dog trying to learn new tricks, really, like, you know, but they were lovely. I have to say now, they had integrity. They were very straight, very honest, you know. So for me, the reason I did go with them in the first place was because they had no baggage. And I really admired the two female leaders. I liked the way they did their business. And I believed in them, and I still believe in them. They're exceptional. But, you know, I suppose for likes of rural areas and stuff, and I'm sure it'll be a lot different for the next election. Their membership has grown. They'll be running a lot more candidates, you know, very intelligent young people in it, who are hungry for it. You know, they're hungry to get in and get stuck on. I don't believe in this being a councillor or whatever for 20 years. I think that's unhealthy. I think one or two terms and it should be called quits after that. You know, we need new, fresh ideas all the time.
And you mentioned there, you know, that the Social Democrats and, you know, they're up and coming and living out an awful lot of young people that are hungry for it. I mean, how is your appetite at this stage, June? Do you see yourself ever going back into politics, even at a local level? No,
never again.
Never again.
Never again.
Lessons learned.
Yeah.
And anything of any value to you that you could take from it, you have taken from it and applied it to your life, and you're moving on.
Yeah, like there was, you know, there was the whole Sinn Féin debacle. Got out of that. Then you're an independent. It didn't really feel like much of a change, actually, because I was doing the work myself anyway.
Yes.
And my mother passed away during it as well. There was an awful lot that happened within that 5 years. I suppose a lot of people would have said to me, you know, you've had the worst introduction into politics a person could ever have. And they were right. I remember my mother was buried on the Saturday, and I got a phone call at 8 o'clock in the morning on the Monday saying, I'm really sorry to hear your mum passed, but. And I just, that sticks out in my memory, because I just thought, it's not worth this.
Yeah, it's just definitely not. Definitely not. The whole politics, you've drawn a line under that to the role that you're in now, June, right? So you're working as a domestic violence support worker, and you are with YANA North Cork Domestic Violence Project. I was staggered to read somewhere fairly recently, there was an 88% increase in domestic violence cases in Ireland in 2020. Tell me a little bit about your role and about the project itself. I mean, you're clearly flourishing in it anyway, because I know that you're very enthusiastic about it. You're very motivated by the work that you do. What brought you to it?
Well, I'm a survivor myself of domestic violence. And when I was a counsellor, I would have done a lot of work with Jana, either, you know, helping their clients with certain issues or sending women to them for help and support. And we managed to actually, we collaborated together to try and get a safe house for the organisation, because they had none and they were in desperate need of one. And thankfully, you know, as a counsellor, I was able to help them with that. So they were able to get a safe house, you know, which has been fantastic for them. So we kind of knew each other anyway from different roles. Mm. And I saw the job appear. But I had always made a promise to myself anyway, Kevin, that if I was ever in a position that I could give back to an organization like that, that I would. Mm. And that was where my head was at when we worked on the safe house. So I started to volunteer with them as well. And then a job came up in there and I applied for it and it made it through the rounds. Like it wasn't easy get the job, I can tell you. Mm. There was a lot of competition, but anyway, I got the job and I've been there now for a year and a half. And I work as a domestic violence support worker down in Cork East. So I would cover the entire area of East Cork. Mm. And hopefully funding will come through where we can get another support worker in there. So I work one-to-one with women. We do court accompaniment. And it's fantastic to be able to offer a service like that to women down there, because there wasn't a service down there before Jana, and they would have had to go to the city for help. And if someone is financially abusing you, having to get to the city is a no-go, because you won't have the money to do it and you won't have the freedom to get there. So that's what I do now. I'm really happy at doing it. I feel like it's a really good fit. And for the women then, you know, they've often said that because I'm a survivor myself, they don't need to go into the nitty-gritty details constantly to try and make me understand what they're going through, because yes, I already know. And not taking away, every story is different, obviously.
Of course, yeah.
But there's a different level of understanding there, and they find that comforting, you know.
Mm, so, like, yeah, and I mean, I'd agree 100% with you that it really sort of enhances what is, at the end of the day, a relationship. It's a relationship of trust. It's a relationship of support. But it's fair to say that, you know, whatever it is, whether you're a domestic violence survivor or a sexual abuse survivor or an addiction survivor or whatever, peer support really is where it's at, isn't it? You know, that if you have somebody in your corner who has lived their version of your experience, nobody, of course, as you've acknowledged there a while ago, nobody will have lived your experience, because everybody's experience is entirely unique. But to find yourself in a situation where you have to leave your home for your safety and for the safety of your child. I mean, what was that like?
And that was even after we had gone to court and got a safety and barring order. The judge said to me, he said, "This isn't going to keep you safe." And I said, "I know, Your Honor, but I have to start someplace, you know." And we left that day. It was the day after I had got a barring order in court. And we had left that day. Mum and Dad drove us out the back way of town. We were hiding behind the seats with a blanket over us. I know it sounds crazy, but that's the level of fear we were experiencing at the time, and we were terrified that he would follow us. So we went up to Clare, and we lived in the refuge for 4 months. We didn't really get to see our family because we were afraid that he would follow them up and find out where we were. But after about 4 months, I felt strong enough to go out and start looking for a place to live. And of course, when you're dealing with different services, you have to repeat your story about 1,000 times.
Yeah.
Which was very difficult to do. But we found an apartment and we moved in there. And again, we didn't really see much of family, or I think it was a good 6 months or so before we saw them, just because we needed to be careful. And even walking around, Dennis, if I did walk around there, you know, you'd be so paranoid. You'd be looking at every car, freaking whether, you know, someone from Mitchestown sees you or passes by. And, you know, you'd have all these kind of paranoid fears that, you know, he might find out where you are. But yeah, it was really difficult. We'd nothing. We left with a box of Jerry's toys and an overnight bag.
Oh boy. I mean, that is, it's unfathomable, really, isn't it? It's unfathomable to anybody who has regular, healthy relationships. And, you know, I'm sorry, I'm tripping over my words here now, because I'll be honest, I don't even know where to go next after hearing that, except maybe to say, look, that, I mean, you're, experience, and I don't want to patronize, you know, right? It has clearly made you stronger.
Yeah.
It has clearly made you more resilient.
Yeah.
And from what you're saying to me, I get a very definite sense from you that the reason that it has made you stronger and it has made you resilient, or a big part of it, is that you had the support that you had at the time that you got to that refuge, and you had, you know, this network of people and services around you who didn't know you personally, but had your best interest at heart. So here you are, having gone full circle, working with the YANA North Cork Domestic Violence Project, and you've gone in now into the role of the supporter.
Yeah.
And is the work that you do, I would imagine that it's massively rewarding, right?
Oh, absolutely.
To get positive outcomes for, you know, for victims of just vile abuse. Does it ever challenge you? Do people's situations and, you know, people's stories, does that ever bring you to places that you thought that you had left behind, but maybe, you know, there's a bit of a residue still somewhere in you?
For me, no, because I suppose I've talked quite openly about my own experience, and it feels like, you know, it was such a different person. I mean, I was a shell of a woman, to be honest. There was nothing left inside, Kevin. I was just gone. Do you know what I mean? I was, the abuse had made me so sick. I'd lost so much weight. I wasn't eating. I was living on cans of Coke and cigarettes. My nerves were shot.
Yeah.
The difference to that person, to who I am now, is huge. No, it's actually never done that. And I think because I have spoken about it so openly before I went into the role, really helped me in that sense. There are things that frustrate you, you know, with courts and family law. We really have a lot of work to do around that area. Obviously, domestic violence needs a lot more funding than it's getting. You know, it's unfortunate that COVID has hit, but for a lot of women out there, it just exasperated it to the point where they just had to reach out and get help.
Yeah.
And, you know, for them, they'd been living with it for a very long time. COVID had just, you know, exasperated the abuse to a point where
amplified
they couldn't,
it. amplified
absolutely.
It. Yeah, because I'd imagine that those, that, you know, those types of households with those sort of figures in them, you know, these abusive spouses and partners, that I'd imagine that that kind of house, I'd imagine that the walls just close in because there's nowhere else for anybody to go to kind of to blow off steam, or you know, the house becomes almost a kind of like a pressure cooker.
Yeah.
What's your hope for the project itself, for the YANA project itself, and for your role within the project going forward? If you were to go to sleep tonight and wake up tomorrow morning and the project was an ideal project, what would it look like compared to what it is now?
It'd be a very, very busy project with a lot more support workers, more funding, more supports available for counselling and all that kind of stuff, you know, to have our own counsellor even employed full time and to keep up with the numbers that are coming in, and just more money really, so that you can put it back into the project and put it out there for women. And that would mean more support workers, counsellors, supports, access to supports that they need. We get donations from Critical in Cork, the volunteer centre, and the Hygiene Bank in Middleton give us donations. It could be food, it could be washing powder, shampoos, conditioners, nappies, bedding, whatever it is.
Mm.
And we store that in our centre so that we can give the woman a bag and she can go in private and take whatever she needs. That then frees up a bit of money at the end of the week, that if their son needs shoes or if there's a bill, they might be able to put something towards it, frees up a bit of cash. You see the likes of Women's Aid who are exceptional, and you know, the money they get in fundraising, you know, which is badly needed for any service. But I would say to people, have a look at your own area and see if there's a refuge or a domestic violence service there first before you go outside the area, because they need the funding. They need the donations to come in because they're looking after women locally. And they don't get the kind of supports that the likes of Women's Aid get, or, you know. And I don't want to take anything away from Women's Aid. I think they're exceptional. But if you are donating to a domestic violence service, just see if there's any local projects around, because they would be so grateful for that kind of support.
Is there something in place, June, where, you know, where somebody could maybe set up a rolling donation to the YANA project now specifically? I mean, the North Cork project that you're working with. Is there a way for somebody to make a subscription to that? Or,
well, I know we're looking at like a donation button on Facebook at the minute, or something like that. I'm not very technical now, Kevin.
Okay, yeah, so, yeah.
But I know we're looking at something. But in the interim, if anyone does want to, all they have to do is to ring the office and they'll be able to make a donation there or send it in to them, you know.
Okay. June, I could talk to you all day. The clock has absolutely barreled here. Oh, I'm just looking at the time here and I'm thinking, have we really been talking for that long? It has been an absolute pleasure, right?
It certainly has. I
have to say that, you know, I've always had good time for you, as they say. And of course, we share a birthday.
We do.
It's the 16th of August. We share our birthday with Madonna. Steve Carell, the actor. I know that James Cameron, the filmmaker, the guy that made Titanic and Avatar, he's the 16th of August. And another strong woman as well, actually, who you share a birthday with, is the actress Angela Bassett.
Oh, right. Very
right,
nice.
You see? There you go. So, you know, I have a feeling that this isn't going to be our last conversation, because I think that, you know, as they say in politics, I think that there is a job of work to be done. Have you any parting shot, June? Any words of wisdom to sign off on?
Any words of wisdom? God, just don't be afraid of change. Change is nothing to fear. It gives a great sense of freedom.
I think that's a great note to go out on. Don't be Afraid of change. Change is nothing to fear. It gives a great sense of freedom. Hugh Murphy, thank you so much for your time.
You're most welcome, Kevin. Thank you.
That's all from this episode of This Fruitful Mind. My thanks again to June for joining me for a chat. If you'd like to contact YANA North Cork Domestic Violence Project to find out more about the services they provide, to volunteer or to make a donation, you can contact their office in Mallow at 022 53915. That's 022 53915. So yes, big thanks again to June Murphy for being my guest today. I have many more interesting guests lined up with whom I'll be chatting about all kinds of topics as diverse from each other as helicopter parenting, anxiety remedies and assassination attempts. So do please keep listening and subscribe wherever you like to listen to your podcasts. As I've mentioned in the previous episodes, I'd love to hear from you. So please drop me a line or 10 at thisfruitfulmind@gmail.com or message me on Facebook, Instagram or Twitter. I'm easily found on all three. If you enjoyed this episode, you might please consider buying me a coffee. You can do so at buymeacoffee.com/Kevin McCormick. I'll talk to you soon. In the meantime, be kind to yourself, gentle with others and open to being brave. Go on, I'll talk to you. This Fruitful Mind is independently written and produced by Kevin McCormick.